Are your school days out of sight? When you took English, art, and math, what's your favorite Fahrenheit? How sour are the grapes of wrath? Do you need a challenger or disgusting Salinger? Do you love the written word? What happened to the mockingbird? Our show is just beginning, so find a place to sit. These questions will be on the test. It's time for Sophomore Lit.
Welcome back to Sophomore Lit, where we reread your 10th grade reading list. I'm John McCoy, and with me is returning co-host Daniel Dotti.
Hey, everybody. It's your Sophomore Lit politics and American letters of the 1850s correspondent, Daniel Dotti.
Okay, remind everyone out there who you are and what you do and where else I can hear you.
Yeah, sure. So professionally, I am a public librarian in the Birmingham, Alabama metro area. And you can listen to me natter on about other sorts of books over on a podcast that I co-host called The Cannonball. That's Cannonball. There with my co-host Claude Myron Guzer, we are reading through a different reading list, the Harold Bloom's Western Canon. So if you're the type of person who enjoys listening to a couple people natter on about books that they found interesting or otherwise, then check us out over at the Cannonball.
Thanks, Daniel, for coming on. This was a topic I cooked up when I realized I needed to get something done quickly. but I still think it's a worthy topic, mm-hmm. and I think that we'll probably have some stuff to say about it. These are George Orwell's two probably most famous essays, Politics and the English Language, and Shooting an Elephant.
Mm-hmm.
Politics and the English Language was from 1946. The later of the two, Shooting an Elephant, was from what, 1936?
Yeah, it was published in 36 about events in the about 10 years earlier in the 20s.
If it's okay with you, Dan, I'm mm-hmm. going to go backwards with this. I'm going to start with
yeah.
English Language and go back and end with Shooting an Elephant. These are essays that get taught a lot in expository writing classes. Like if you get like the Norton Anthology of just writing, it has one or the other of these as an essay. I know that when I was teaching briefly in a university program when I was getting my master's, I taught a class in composition, and I assigned Shooting an Elephant. So mm-hmm. I do know that this is a part of the curriculum. However, I sort of remembered them with a little bit of rose-tinted glasses. So this time through, I was struck by a lot of stuff in these. Mm-hmm. These essays. Have you read either of these essays before?
So I have never read Politics in the English Language before, and I was very, and I hadn't read all the way to, I see now with the link that you sent me at the very bottom, it mentions when it was published, and I did not actually read past those footnotes at the bottom to see that. I'm very interested to see that it is late in his career, just prior to the, what would have been the composition and publishing of 1984. You can tell this is on his mind. I have read Shooting an Elephant before, and I cannot recall what class it was. I believe it would have been in university. It might have been like a freshman comp class, or it may have been some other class where we had like touched on kind of imperialism or something, you know, along those lines. But I do remember like reading the Shooting an Elephant essay, and I remember being pretty transfixed by it. Like as a narrative, it's well, I guess like you said, there's a reason it's taught in comp classes.
I think both of these are highly engaging,
mm-hmm.
and they're pretty short. That was the other thing that surprised me reading them through this time, was how compact they are.
Yeah,
it makes sense because Orwell's whole point in Politics of the English Language is, you know, the general writing rule of be simple, be direct.
Mm-hmm.
But what is different about this essay from just like reading The Elements of Style or something like that,
mm-hmm.
is the political aspect of this, that Orwell has this theory that he works out in this essay, Indistinct writing leads to bad politics, and bad politics leads to indistinct writing.
Yeah.
And there's this, there's a way in which it feeds on itself. But he has the greatest contempt for the way in which people hide what they're actually saying politically behind indistinct language. And for him, indistinct language is the overuse of cliches.
Yeah.
The overuse of Latinate words, of non-concrete nouns.
Yeah. Yeah. This one was, I guess what struck me most with it was a kind of, I'm sure you're familiar with the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis in linguistics, John, right?
Right.
Yeah. No, that's,
tell me.
Okay, you're right. Well, for any listeners who might not be familiar, this was a very controversial theory that was ginned up in the mid-20th century. I don't know a lot of details about it, but the upshot being that given how it's a theory that one's perception of the world is molded by the terms which themselves sort of represent kind of conceptual elements that you bring to your observations, right? So different people speaking different languages will literally experience the world in a different way. And to say that, like, well, that's a little bit of a common sense kind of, you know, conclusion, it's not quite as simple as, like, well, they'll describe it differently. The Sapir-Whorf hypothesis is that it's essentially a different reality when you not even expressing anything. You don't have to speak anything. It's just if you've been raised in a language that provides you with the sort of mental building blocks to construct your own kind of conception of what's going on around you. They really stake their flag way out there. And Orwell's contention here, I think, is in that wheelhouse. I don't think it's quite as, you know, he's not stamping the flag out as far as the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis there, but I think the interplay that he claims is going on between kind of these indistinct language usages leading to certain political conceptions themselves. Like, it's not just a matter of, well, it's the spin house, right? The spin doctors are, like, massaging language and using their bullet points to, you know, position their claims as best they can. He is saying that, like, no, this is having the effect of actually having a compounding effect on the politics themselves, which was, I'm not fully convinced, but I'm happy to entertain the idea.
I'm a little more convinced of the point he makes about the way in which politicians, or let's be honest, business speak, anyone in a position of authority might make an unpalatable or an unethical policy, they sell it to their audience by abstracting what they're actually saying.
Mm-hmm.
So he gives the example that was probably very close to his mind at that time of leftist intellectuals forgiving Stalinism.
Yes,
because
yes.
The it's important that Soviet Russia has this this maybe regrettable purges, just so that eventually the revolution can bring a socialist utopia to the world.
Well, like, yeah, as it says here in the essay, you know, defending Russian totalitarianism, he cannot say outright, quote, "I believe in killing off your opponents when you can get good results by doing so," end quote. Which I do think is it's an extremely blunt way of putting, you know, I would say maybe, you know, another way to put that would be like, you know, there are things necessary to ensure the survival of this political project, which I think is important. You know, oh, I'm sorry if I engaged in Orwell's, you know, vices with that one. But it is a great example, though, of the kind of obfuscating language. There I am using Latinate words with the quote that he does provide as an example of that. I have it pulled up right here if we have time for me to read the whole thing.
Sure, go ahead.
Yeah, so I do think this is a good example of what Orwell is talking about. So he's saying, you know, this is the obfuscation at work. Quote, "While freely conceding that the Soviet regime exhibits certain features which the humanitarian may be inclined to deplore, we must, I think, agree that a certain curtailment of the right to political opposition is an unavoidable concomitant of transitional periods. and that the rigors which the Russian people have been called upon to undergo have been amply justified in the sphere of concrete achievement. And yeah, that's a lot of fluff to avoid saying the direct claim, which, you know, put your money where your mouth is. You know, if you're going to claim it, claim it.
When I was younger and I read this, I didn't read this for any particular class, but I remember being told that this was a important essay, and it is an essay that gets referenced a lot.
Mm-hmm.
So I read it on my own, and I remember saying, yeah, right on, Orwell, when I was a kid. But now that I'm older,
yeah,
here's a few things that bother me.
Yeah.
I think it's very easy if you're an educated person, mm-hmm. by which I mean if you've been a product of a university education, to develop a certain superiority complex about grammar. Everyone does it, and everyone has their own personal phrase that just rubs them the wrong way. My dad used to forever go on and on about how you can't say hopefully at the beginning of a sentence to mean I hope. Because technically, if you say hopefully we will go to the store tomorrow,
right,
what you're actually saying is you're going to go to the store with hope in your heart. And
right,
he
right.
would tell me this over and over and over again, and I always thought, like, oh my God, you know, give it a break, Dad. but I remember in the early 90s,
mm-hmm.
people had never used the word impact as a verb before.
Oh,
but
yeah.
Sometime in the late 80s, early 90s, they started to use impact as a verb, as in this decision impacts the community.
Yeah.
Or this is a very impactful choice you made.
I really hate the word impactful.
Right. And it drove me insane.
Yeah.
And I was mostly because I thought the word you want is effect.
Yeah.
And why aren't you using the word effect? And I remember at the time I brought this up with one of my professors, who kind of shrugged her shoulders and said, well, you know, the exact same thing happened with the word contact earlier in the century.
Yeah.
Contact was only a noun, and then people started using it as a verb. I think she was trying to get me to let go of, this thing of impact, but what it had the effect of, I now do not use contact as a verb.
Yeah. Well, you're right, and it is a you know, what's the word I'm looking for? It's on the tip of my tongue. See, we're talking about language. Deconcretizing. You can get me there. Anyway, it did strike me as rather curmudgeonly. Like, if there's one thing that I don't have a lot of patience for, it's like proscriptive, you know, language kind of scolding. And while I do understand the point that he's making regarding vague language and sort of rote language, like we're just plugging in the cliche or what have you, I don't know. All in all, like, I think it's kind of, you know, it's just yelling at clouds, really. But I did think he had a very good... I kind of second-guessed myself, though, as I was reading it, because there was a paragraph which really struck me as, like, right in line with something that really annoys me. So I thought maybe I'll give the rest a chance. But it was talking about the way that political words are similar are abused, right? And so he has this portion here about meaningless words. He says, many political words are similarly abused. The word fascism has now no meaning, except insofar as it signifies, quote, something not desirable, end quote. The words democracy, socialism, freedom, patriotic, realistic, justice have each of them several different meanings which cannot be reconciled with one another. And this is absolutely spot on. The way that, especially things like the words like freedom, or democracy, especially in the kind of political milieu that we as 21st century, you know, Americans are in. Those are terms that get tossed around a lot, and no one means the same thing as someone else when they're using it. And in a bit of irony, I found myself thinking, well, that's how the word Orwellian has become. It is simply a signifier for something I don't like. what a horrible irony.
You know, it's true, but one of the things about this, about the indistinctness of certain concepts, and particularly political concepts, people are going to argue over what, you know, people argue all the time over what is communism, what is socialism. You're people who are both supporters and detractors will say you shouldn't be conflating the two, but people do. But then you have to define your terms, and you know the everyone's favorite response on Twitter is America is not a democracy, it's a republic.
Right. God, that one. Back when I had the youthful vigor to get in the trenches with internet wars, that was my I could never leave that one alone. I always. Eventually I got to the point where I was saying, like, yes, I know America's not a democracy, and that's the problem, you know, sign off.
The thing is, I don't think the answer is not to use these words. I think the answer is to do what most academics do when they do this, is to deconstruct the word and to explain its use and its meaning and its complications. This is pretty... this is pretty old hat at this point. I'm looking at this on the other side of post-structuralism and deconstructionism. Another thing that Orwell hates is the use of foreign words.
Yeah,
but sometimes those are the words, you know, like he says, you know, you can't use the phrase deus ex machina. I'm like, but what do you mean? What if you need to talk about Deus Ex Machina? That's a very
specific thing. Yeah, it's a handy term. I thought that was so funny when he was talking about using like Saxon words and all that stuff. Because it's like, buddy, like, I'm sorry, like the Saxons were dominated by a Latinate speaking people beginning in the 11th century. You know, for a few centuries, if you're speaking English as it has been spoken since like Chaucer, you're going to have Latin elements in it. Like that's, you know, and I guess maybe he's specifically referring to like the sort of introduction of Neo-Latinisms in like Enlightenment era or whatever, when everyone was trying to gussy up their languages when they were codifying them. But like, that just struck me as a particularly like, if you know, if the goal of this, of writing is to clearly communicate with your intended audience, And your intended audience knows what Deus Ex Machina means, and it's useful for you to use. I'm not going to sit there and find the old English term for when Woden appears in the epic to insert in there. I'm sorry, you know.
I know Orwell was in and out of college. He didn't quite finish. Let me see what his educational. He was a King's Scholar at Eton, but I don't think he actually got his degree eventually. He dropped out.
I think that's right. He was kind of set up for the posh education, which of course would have included a lot of Latin and Greek, and that would have been, you know. And so I have to imagine, like, if he, you know, if we're right in our presumptions, then he did kind of turn his back, or at least like had a very fragmentary educational experience, which was punctuated by, of course, his famously recounted in Down and Out in Paris and London. Like, he actually did live a very hand-to-mouth existence for, you know, a good stretch of time, whether or not he had to. I think that's kind of an interesting, like, was he the subject of Pulp's Common People, or was he actually living a hardscrabble existence? But he certainly seemed to have a chip on his shoulder about the language habits of the upper crust, I guess.
He came from fallen nobility. His like grandparents were titled, but like by the time he got down to the father, his family was not was kind of living in what he called lower middle class, mm-hmm. and that's one of the reasons why he had to eventually leave university and go to work in Burma. Now, I don't bring this up because I want to be classist about being getting an education is mm. better than the other ways that one can can maneuver through life. But I do think when I read this, it smacks me of a very smart person who is an autodidact.
Mm-hmm.
At one point, he talks about how the word romantic is used by art historians and it's meaningless. And I'm here to say, I have a degree in art history, and romanticism refers to a very specific time in right. 19th century art. It has very specific characteristics and very specific artists that practiced it. So I feel like what is happening is he is guilty of misunderstanding this term, mm-hmm. and therefore he thinks that the term is useless.
It must necessarily be being used indistinctly because he can't really see the distinctions that are being made.
Right.
It's a little bit of sour grapes, I would think.
And the other thing that occurred to me as I read this was, you know, he talks a lot about how using Latinate words and indistinct diction, choosing hackneyed cliches and turns of phrase is a way of lulling your audience into complacency and getting assent to things that they might not otherwise give assent to.
Yeah.
And that is something that I do believe and I do worry about. But I would like to point out that we have just come from an administration where the president regularly said nothing, and he used very short words to say them.
Right.
I would say that in some ways he was a brilliant rhetorician mm-hmm. to the people who loved him.
Yes.
And they what they loved about what Trump supporters loved about him was the fact that he used such short words.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the thing that worries me. I don't know that language ultimately is going to save us.
Yeah. Yeah.
If people want to hear what they want to hear, they're going to hear it.
Right. And if they want to, you know, and the I think that is very interesting that we now have, you know, we have an administration whose communications strategies are much more sophisticated and much more in the mold of what Orwell's complaining about, especially in the sense of, like, you know, massaging language or using terminology to make unpalatable things more palatable to whatever particular audience you're actually talking to. If, you know, I'm thinking specifically of, like, the language around the ways in which migrant people are detained at the border, right? Like, with the new administration, right. there's been a lot more kind of preciousness about how they're phrasing things. But I do think you're right that, like, the... Well, we can go... Like, I think, you know, if we look at the rules that he comes up with for how to clean up languages act and make it more politically responsible, and we can see the big kind of looming gap here. So here are his rules. Never use a metaphor, simile, or other figure of speech which you're used to seeing in print. Never use a long word where a short one will do. If it is possible to cut a word out, always cut it out. Never use the passive where you can use the active. Never use a foreign phrase, a scientific word, or a jargon word if you can think of an everyday English equivalent. And lastly, break any of these rules sooner than say anything outright barbarous. Thank you, George, for that out. But like you said, with the previous administration, he pretty much followed all those rules without saying anything. He still squirted the squid ink. It was still all squid ink. So, this prescriptivism is, you know, I see where you're frustrated, George or Eric, to use your real name. But I don't know if this is the way out.
I do think that Orwell in these two essays has the courage of his convictions.
Absolutely.
Though,
yeah.
Both of these are very short essays, and I was struck at the end of each essay by how unceremoniously they end. They just kind of stop.
Yeah.
There's no like winding down. It's just like, okay, I'm done.
Well, especially with shooting an elephant, like, you know, I'm pulled up and I'm looking at the ending right now. Like, there is a kind of like, there is a little bit of a bow tied on it, which I guess we'll get to. But yeah, you're right. It does just kind of, there's no like, you know, in conclusion, Burma is a land of contrast. Like, there's not really anything like that.
Right. So this is a good time to segue over to shooting an elephant, which is maybe give a little bit of context here. Orwell served in the local constabulary. He was a police officer for Empire in Burma, in Mull Mine. I know Mull Mine mostly from the Rudyard Kipling.
Oh, yeah.
Ollie Speaks song, The Road to Mandalay, which I hate to admit this to people. I really love that song. I know that it's a terrible, terrible. I know that it's a terrible thing, and I know that Kipling was awful to be such an apologist for the British Empire. But I do find it very charming.
Well, honestly, in a funny way. I mean, you can't. We're all taken in by the Victorians and the way that they made, they really did make a world-spanning, blood-soaked empire sound fun. as just an unending canvas to paint your own boy's adventure on, but it happens to be everywhere in the world where people live.
Right. Well, someday I'll have you back on and we can read H. Rider Haggard.
I would love to. I've actually never read him before. So this will be very.
Let me put in a little plug here. If you're the kind of reader who can read Victoriana, and can distance yourself from some of the unsavory emphasis upon the English superiority over the rest of the world, read She by H. Rider Haggard. It is the most crazy, bonkers, bizarre, lost world adventure, and you will see where Edgar Rice Burroughs got all of his ideas.
Oh, wow, yeah. Okay, yeah, now I'm really looking forward to it. The extent of my familiarity with She by Haggard is, if you've ever watched Rumpole of the Bailey, Rumpole refers to his wife as she who must be obeyed.
Exactly. well, it's a good book to read if you're a Rumpole fan too. I do apologize. It's also a terrible book, but it's a good book, but it's a terrible book.
I think your listeners are sophisticated enough to understand what you're saying, that you can find interest and value in texts, even if, say, the kind of moral grounding that they're working with is something that you do find objectionable. I mean, you're talking to a guy who, I'm an armchair classicist, a very armchair, because I only read in translation. So, you know, but I'm fascinated with the ancient world, and I love to read, you know, texts that are generated by it. But at the same time, every time I always have to, you know, I keep in the back of my head thinking about all the slaves who made the lifestyle of this writer possible.
Well, speaking of things that are good but also awful,
yes,
shooting an elephant. Orwell was a policeman for Empire, and he was in Burma. Mm-hmm. I suppose I should point out present-day Myanmar. This is his account of what it was like to be in a position of some authority, like a middle management position of some authority in Burma. It's interesting because this is between the wars.
Mm-hmm.
So this is sort of the end of Empire. This is like Britain trying to hold on, you know, as long as it can. The writing's on the wall.
Right. Like, the first World War really broke the back of the British Empire, even though they were on the winning side. Like, that was really kind of the great break point, really for all of the European empires, but for Great Britain especially. Like, they, you know, it was more or less explicit that they were handing the baton over to the United States of America by 1918.
This is an account of how he was called to deal with a wild elephant. I mean, a domesticated elephant that had gone wild, that had gone into heat and had been destroying property. And by the time he gets to investigate it, he finds has actually killed a person. But it's also an essay about the relationship between the colonizer and the colonized. And it's a little rough to read in that way, because on the one hand, I see Orwell's point as being progressive for its time, but he does use terribly racist language in describing the Burmese. And this is an interesting point, because one of the things he says is this, the tension between the native people and the conquering people creates a world in which both sides dehumanize each other, because both sides are trying to make the other's lives as miserable as possible.
Yeah.
And so in a way, referring to them with the language that he does is reinforcing that idea, but I don't know that it really it really excuses it.
Well, I think the ambivalence, it's an ambivalence which is still sharpened with imperial ideology in a very strange way. I think a passage that really jumped out to me was that it's toward the beginning. I think it's in the second paragraph, where he's just kind of setting up, you know, his job there in Burma, and he says here, "All I knew was that I was stuck between my hatred of the empire I served and my rage against the evil-spirited little beasts who tried to make my job impossible." That's referring to the Burmese there. "With one part of my mind, I thought of the British Raj as an unbreakable tyranny, as something clamped down in saecula saeculorum upon the will of prostrate peoples. With another part, I thought that the greatest joy in the world would be to drive a bayonet into a Buddhist priest's guts. Feelings like these are the normal byproducts of imperialism. Ask any Anglo-Indian official if you catch him off duty." So that even in, you know, recognizing that he is a violent interloper in these people's lives, he still can't help but think of them as evil-spirited little beasts who are making his job impossible. And it's like, yeah, man, your job is evil. Like, what do you expect?
I'd also like to point out that he uses the phrase in saecula saeculorum in direct contrast to what he will eventually write in Politics in the English Language.
Yes.
This is a essay, I think, that can be read and enjoyed and be instructive to a contemporary reader, but it takes that suspension, that ability to kind of put aside the things that are problematic. Now, I don't know. It may be easier for me as a white middle class American to do that than if I were from Southeast Asia and I read this. I think it might be a little rougher.
Yeah, but I think you're right. That it still has value. I would think, and like, you know, well, here's a little window curated for us by an imperial actor into the mindset of the empire on the ground, right? Like, it still has, like, you know, we can object to what's going on here, as Orwell himself does, but still find value in having at least a first-hand account of, like, well, what's going through this person's head when he is there as the embodiment of empire to these people in this little town.
The other thing that I think this essay does really well is that once the narrative gets going, it becomes quite gripping. You don't know where it's going to end. You don't know what's going to happen after the young Orwell discovers that the elephant has in fact killed someone, he sends for an elephant gun. Mm-hmm. He says just to defend himself, but when the locals see that he's got an elephant gun, they come out. There are people who want to see an elephant get killed just for the sport of it.
Just the spectacle.
And there are people who want to butcher the elephant once it's dead for its meat. Mm-hmm. And he talks about this growing crowd behind him that's pushing, that he feels is psychically pushing him on to the point that he will eventually have no choice. He mm-hmm. did not want to, he said, as shoot the elephant, but he finds himself being compelled to. I don't know that I believe him in some of these ways. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know that I believe when he sent for the gun that he didn't intend to use it.
Yeah, I think some important context in all this is Orwell writing 10 years after the events. And he's also right. I mean, this is his polished, presented, you know, here's what I want you to think I was thinking, you know, basically. and I don't know enough to know how honest an appraisal this is. You know, I don't know that anyone could know that unless you're, you know, very steeped in the man's sort of letters and archival material, I guess.
The actual shooting of the elephant. I don't think that's a spoiler because it's right there in the title.
Yeah.
When Orwell actually has to shoot the elephant, this I think is actually a very masterful and gripping and heartbreaking passage. Poor little Eric, as you say, Eric is Blair's real name. Doesn't really know what to do or how to kill an elephant. He shoots the elephant in the wrong place, and the elephant, the description of how the elephant falls to its knees, stunned, looking, you know, he's basically lobotomized this elephant, and it's just heartbreaking, but it's also so physical and so weirdly poetic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a very moving essay, and I just now realized how much more, well, I don't know, the elephant is treated with more respect and dimensionality than any of the Burmese people. I mean, it's just kind of as I'm, and they're typically a mass, like, you know, there's that portion here, as, you know, here he is, he's, you know, he has the gun, he's, you know, he has the crowd behind him, and he writes, "Here was I, the white man with his gun, standing in front of the unarmed native crowd, seemingly the lead actor of the piece, but in reality I was only an absurd puppet, pushed to and fro by the will of those yellow faces behind. I perceived in this moment that when the white man turns tyrant, it is his own freedom that he destroys." Which I thought was an interesting passage because, for one, you're really a puppet of your higher-ups in the Imperial office. That's who you're a puppet of. But I know, like, you know, but that's still a very moving kind of way of thinking about, like, you're sweating bullets in the moment because you're being observed by all these people, and you have to perform the role of the Imperial in front of them, right? But that's only because of the motivations and needs of people way up the chain from you. You know, that's making you do this. But it's But they're kind of undifferentiated, I guess.
Yeah, I think you've hit the nail on the head there with that. I think that Orwell is blaming the wrong people here.
Right. Right.
It does smack a little bit of, like, well, consider how hard it is to be a white guy.
Right. Well, yeah, I mean, it is a bit of a, like, you know, the I'm a victim too here. And the thing is, like, in a way he is. And that's the sick kind of, you know, grinding that happens in an Imperial order, is that, like, you know, Great Britain conquered the world. Because, you know, in large, well, they had, you know, the certain technological advantages, but also because they had a huge reserve of desperate guys at home who were willing to sign up to go halfway around the world to go, you know, die of scurvy on a ship, because they're, you know, not to get all, not to get all into the vast, you know, cogs of imperialism here, but like, you know, the British Empire was about taking poor Scottish guys and shipping them halfway around the world to go murder brown people. Like, there are a lot of kinds of victimhood happening when you look at it in a certain way. Yeah,
that hits a little home. The McCoy name, as best we can tell, originated with Scotch-Irish, that is, the Scottish people who were sent to Ireland to keep the locals down.
Yeah, to ethnically cleanse my forebears, actually.
Right. The first ancestor of mine with the name McCoy mm-hmm. in America came from Ulster, so it all checks out.
Yeah,
And it's a little bit hard because I live in Boston. And when people hear my name McCoy, they say, "Oh, they assume
right.
I'm Irish," and they say like, and Irish people will say like, "Well, what county are you from?"
Yeah,
and I'm like,
"Well, it's toward the north, you know."
But I mean, on the other hand, that's like six generations back.
Right, right. That's, yeah.
It's just because we count one man's name.
One, exactly, as being the lineage. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, that, I mean, that's the funny thing. Like, you know, my own name is a, you know, it's a horrible morass of G's and H's that comes out of County Donegal. So up there in the north, part of the historical region of Ulster, but not part of the six counties that are Northern Ireland today. I forgot where I was going with it. Oh, right. But like, as so, you know, I happen to be blessed with a fine chiseled bearded face, and I have at one point a woman who I was helping at a library I used to work at said I looked just like the Notre Dame mascot. So there's also like a big strain of like I do have some ties back to the American Revolution through some Dutch people, you know. So it's all a beautiful North Sea melange, we might call it. Despite seeming purebred.
Right. I mean, on my mom's side, I can trace ancestors back to Jamestown, so.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
My family has been in the United States for a long time, and we're kind of mutts at this point. We don't really
exactly.
Have any,
yeah, I mean it's and really like everyone back there is mutts too. I mean let's get real. But but enough of this digression. Let's get back to killing an elephant.
So I remember when I assigned this to my students back in. When I was in grad school, this was probably around 1993, I think, mm-hmm. 1994. I don't remember exactly, but I assigned it then. And I did so without reservation. I thought it was a good essay. And
yeah.
I didn't get any blowback from the students. I want to say it amazes me sort of how much things have changed in a short time.
Yeah, yeah.
What I find acceptable now and what I found acceptable then, very different. And, you know, anyone who watches a teen movie from the 80s knows what I'm talking about.
Yes. Absolutely. No, I know absolutely what you mean. Or even from the 2000s, really. Like, it's, yeah, there. It's. I'm with you, like, because I don't recall... Like, at the time I read it first, like, my recollection of my reaction to it was like, oh, what a very thoughtful guy. You know, he's a really, like, wow, what a strange situation he was put in. He's very thoughtful about it. He recognizes the, you know, the wickedness that he's involved in. And I didn't really think much kind of beyond that, that there's still, he's still looking at it from, you know, it's still couched in that same imperialist mindset, even as he's recognizing the evil at work and what have you, which makes it, I think, you know, honestly, like it has so much more, I don't know, texture to it when I see that. And I think it's much more, I got a lot more out of it this time reading it simply because there was that, well, and also my, I'm going to admit, John, my hackles are kind of up because I've been reading for, well, I don't know if you want to call it pleasure reading. I've been reading for my personal autodidactic edification the book Late Victorian Holocausts by the urbanist and historian Mike Davis, which places a lot of the kind of what's called neocolonialism, the kind of the mad dash to snap up everywhere that wasn't already colonized in the 1870s through 1890s, places it in the context of the fact that there were several major El Nino events in that time span that resulted in widespread famine that was exacerbated and also taken advantage of by the European powers to expand their power and basically conquer the entire world except for Japan, Siam, and Ethiopia, which actually was the time span when Burma came fully under the control of the British Empire. It was in the 1880s that the region that Orwell was assigned to fell into, you know, full British control in the midst of this phenomenon that Mr. Davis calls the Late Victorian Holocaust. So reading all of this, you know, this is about 40 years after that, right? This is a couple generations out from that. But my like I said, my hackles were really up to be on the lookout for imperialist ideology because I had just read so much about the most worthless imperial officials making decisions that led to many, many people dying horrible deaths. So I think that I was perhaps in a bit of, you know, I was ready to be affected and explore this a little deeper than the first time I read it.
This was time when I read it through, I was very aware of what a masterful rhetorician Orwell mm-hmm. is in this. He wants to get the reader on his side, and he wants yes. the reader to have sympathy for his position, and he wants the reader to buy into the overall project, which is saying this random violent event that happened during my deployment is a perfect encapsulation of empire. And all those things are up for debate.
Mm-hmm.
Could just be this is just what happens in places where people use elephants as beasts of burden, or maybe Orwell had more agency than he's letting on in deciding mm-hmm. what he was going to do with his life. I don't say that to say that Orwell is trying to lie to you or trying to deceive you anyway. I think it just shows how masterful a writer he is and how when you write nonfiction, you're still writing, you're still making story choices, and you're
yes.
making thematic choices.
Yeah.
That's what makes reading so much of a rich experience.
Absolutely. And I think it also, I'd never thought about it before, but I think that right there hit upon why I find the term creative nonfiction so annoying. I understand what it's trying to express. I understand what the mode is attempting, but you're writing. It's all going to be creative, no matter what you're doing. It's just, I'm sorry. Like, that's just, there's always going to be that element of craft and decision and conjuring of images. No matter if you're just telling a story of what happened to you, you know, on the way to work some morning, it's all going to be creative.
I had a course in one of my grad school years with a journalist, Mark Kramer, who was part of the whole new journalism movement of deep embedding into a situation, writing from the perspective of the writer, and utilizing the tools of fiction in writing journalism.
Mm-hmm.
He calls it narrative journalism. I don't know if that
okay.
Sounds any better to you.
That's not quite as clanging in my ears. I like it. That's not going on my Orwellian shit list like all the rest.
We should probably wrap this up. Do you have anything you want to say in some last observations here?
I mean, not really. That I think we covered it all. I would like to say that I think Orwell has been done a great disservice in his afterlife as a writer. He is constantly invoked for the most facile arguments you've ever read in your entire life, and that can turn a lot of people off from him. Also, like, he's kind of in left-wing circles, he's a bit of a hot potato, because on the one hand, his Ode to Catalonia is considered that's a very foundational, very moving piece of left-wing literature, where he's writing about the struggle of people who were involved in the legitimately elected government of the Spanish Republic, attempting to fight off the insurgent militarist revolts of Francisco Franco. Of course, they were ultimately unsuccessful. But also, anyone who ends up naming names, which Orwell did do later in his life, in part because of his disillusionment with the kind of Moscow-oriented socialist groups in Spain, it's all very complicated, and I don't need to go into it. I'm probably making people mad at me even talking about it. But he's an ambivalent figure, even as a figure who's very important to the kind of the history of English letters in the radical tradition, right? But also he's invoked by the dumbest people for the stupidest of reasons, and for some godforsaken reason, Animal Farm, which is one of the most niche pieces of narrative fiction I think ever. It's basically just a note for note allegory of like the 1920s in the Soviet Union, but is presented to people as this universally applicable fable. I think does a lot to kind of make people wary of reading him or engaging seriously with him. But I would encourage everyone to read Orwell. I really want to read more of his. I've never read Down and Out in Paris and London. And having read these essays and kind of gotten my kind of interest in him as a rhetorician and a writer piqued, I'm very interested to read some of his more kind of memoirish material. And that's just to let the readers know and to let you know, John, that I did have a kind of personal moment with George Orwell in reading this, and I'm going to give him a fairer shake, I think, going on, even as, of course, I keep in mind all the things that we talked about today.
Thanks to my co-host, Daniel Dowdy. His podcast is The Cannonball, spelled C-A-N-O-N. Sophomore Lit is brought to you by the Incomparable Network. Find more funny, smart podcasts online at theincomparable.com. You can write the show at sophomore.literature@gmail.com. Or if you'd like to discuss this or any other readings, join in on the Facebook page or the Incomparable membership Slack. I hope you're all staying healthy, and I hope you're all getting vaccinated. Soon we can return to the classroom. And when we do, everything will be on the final.